good evening, everybody. Welcome to another session, and a special welcome to newcomers to the group. Tonight we're pleased to welcome Peter Woodford.
Ludford, I beg your pardon. Peter Ludford.
I think I'm wrong.
Yeah. Who has a long and dangerous history. To sum it up.
Oh no, I've covered dangerous now, I hope he's safe.
Yeah, yes, well indeed, there you go. But anyway, he's been involved in various ways, but especially with the fire service, with assessment of risk. It's interesting that, especially if you go out on the fens in Cambridge, you can find a lot of traces of the old sort of like the Cold War observation posts, sort of lurking, and you can drive past them without seeing them, but if you know where they are, it's worth stopping off having a little visit. And I think they used to have a few Air Force squaddies down there, and if there was ever going to be a nuclear explosion, various observation posts would take bearings on it and report back by telephone cable.
That's half my presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry. But anyway, I do beg your pardon. But it's just interesting to see these things. And, well, we're going to move on to modern developments in the danger industry. So, anyway, I'm sorry to have trodden on your toes, but do keep calm and carry on.
Well, thank you very much. I don't know about you, but I love this place, so keep calm and carry on. For some reason, we're seeing this image everywhere at the moment. I mean, it's reproduced on posters, mugs, tea towels, coasters. And probably like me, it prompts a wry smile because it is obvious stiff upper lip approach from a modern era. Interestingly, it was never actually used. It was produced in 1939 and was the final poster in a set of three. And this one was designed to be displayed in the event of a mainland invasion by German troops, which of course never happened. After the war, all the posters were pulped, but a single copy was found by a bookseller in a pile of old papers some 60 years later. And so it survives to this day. And I've used it as a title for my presentation because I think it's still got resonance today. And it probably sums up the essence of emergency planning over the last 70 odd years. As Ted said, my presentation is going to take you through the evolution of emergency planning from the post-war era, through the dark days of the Cold War, to present day civil contingency planning, and also give you a brief glimpse of what the future might hold for emergency planning. I think the term evolution is the correct one, as we'll find that much of today's emergency planning mechanisms and structures actually draw on past experience. What we will also see is a history of political infighting, denial, over-optimism and plain naivety. So let's start at the beginning. When the war in Europe finished in May 1945, so did the immediate threat to the UK population. Just over 60,000 people had been killed by bombing raids, and damage to buildings and infrastructure would take decades to repair. However, lessons had been learned that would inform the country's civil defence measures for the next 40 years. In 1945, the Air Raid Precautions Organisation, the ARP as it was known, which had become more commonly known as Civil Defence towards the end of the war, was dismantled. But the euphoria of the E-Day and the J-Day was short-lived. In March 1946, Winston Churchill made his first reference to the Iron Curtain. And in the previous year, the term Cold War was coined by none other than George Orwell. A few years later, the Soviet Union tested its first atomic bomb, and suddenly civil defence was back on the agenda. And planners looking back to the last war for ideas. The new measures were led by the Civil Defence Act 1948, which allowed for the introduction of the Civil Defence Regulations. These made county and borough councils responsible for collecting and distributing intelligence about the attack, controlling and coordinating action necessary as a result of the attack, rescue, protection against the toxic effects of atomic, biological and chemical warfare, and advising the public on the effects of attack and protective measures to take. As well as those duties, local authorities would have to organise evacuation and reception, care of the homeless, information centres, disposal of the dead and emergency water supplies. But more importantly, they would also have to organise the new Civil Defence Corps that was to be a key element in the Civil Defence plans. Initially, it was suggested that the Corps should be a branch of the armed forces organised on similar lines to the Army Reserves, but this idea was soon dropped. Instead, the Corps was established as a civilian body, administered by local authorities, similar to the Air Raid Precautions Organisation in the Second World War. The Corps would provide the basic organisation and staff for local authorities to comply with the new civil defence functions. It was to consist of divisions of unpaid but uniformed volunteers who would be enrolled by the Corps authorities, that was the county councils and the county borough councils, and be organised by them. Overall policy and conditions for the Corps were to be determined by the Home Secretary. The 1960s Corps recruiting leaflet described the warden as the vital link between the individual and the mobile services. In a nuclear war, it probably would have been he in those days, would become the leader of his neighbourhood, advising and controlling the public and seeing that the survivors get help and attention. Wardens would be responsible for local reconnaissance and reporting, for the organisation of street work parties, and the deployment of life-saving services within their areas. They also had special responsibilities, connection with warnings of deadly radioactive fallout produced by nuclear explosions, and control of the public in the areas affected by it. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, the Civil Defence planners expected the next war would follow the same basic pattern as the last. There would be widespread conventional air attacks on cities, and from the 1950s, some of these would include atomic bombs and chemical weapons. Plans were made accordingly. In the late 1940s, a national survey was made of all available shelter space. Plans for censorship and blackout were drawn up, and millions of new civilian gas masks were ordered. There was even a working party set up to consider the civil defence arrangements for domestic animals and wild animals in captivity. By the early 1950s, the assumption was that war would begin with an initial onslaught of atomic bombs, after which both sides would recover and fight an extended broken back war with whatever resources could be scraped together. By 1955, plans were being made on the assumption that the UK would be hit by 132 atomic bombs, targeted on seats of government, industry and population, with London receiving 35 bombs. The planners based their calculations on what they called the nominal bomb. This had an explosive power or yield of 20 kilotons, roughly the same as the ones that had been dropped on Japan. It was predicted that these bombs would kill 1,680,000 people and injure a further 957,000. Two-fifths of the country's houses would be wrecked, and half of the manufacturing industry would be destroyed or damaged. The loss of life, casualties and damage would of course be horrendous, but the experience from the Blitz and the attacks on German cities like Hamburg and Dresden, the government suggested that the attacks would not result in a breakdown of society or the system of government. Consequently, civil defence measures were only needed to help survivors in the immediate life-saving period to cope with the immediate and localised effects of the attack. Evacuation was to be an official policy until the early 1960s, and the 1956 Defence White Paper said it was the cornerstone of civil defence. The proposed evacuation scheme showed a mind-boggling scale of a civil defence plan, but also the naivety of some of those plans. The basic plan was changed several times, and in the mid-1950s, the intention was to evacuate virtually all children and their mothers, together with the elderly and the disabled, from the major cities that were expected to be the main targets. This would involve moving over 10 million people in England and Wales, and a further 1 million in Scotland, partly by road, but mainly by rail. And, wait for it, this would be done in 7 days. 1 day for planning, and 6 days for the actual movements. The evacuees would be billeted for an indefinite period with families in the reception areas that would mainly be rural towns or villages. The married men back in the cities would be expected to carry on with business as usual, without their wives and children, while waiting for the bombs to drop. At the same time as this mass evacuation was taking place, over 1 million members of the armed forces would be on the move, together with all their stores and equipment. Vast amounts of food and other strategic materials would be moved from the ports, and 360,000 hospital patients would be relocated, together with 68 million cubic feet of hospital equipment. After the attack, the welfare section would be expected to provide accommodation for any homeless survivors or refugees in rest centres, and organise emergency feeding. In the absence of electricity and gas, and a lack of food in the shops, most people would have to be fed in this way. For this purpose, virtually every school in the country was designated as a rest centre or emergency feeding centre. Accommodation registers were held centrally to ensure that the different agencies from central and local government, the armed services, government ministries, etc., did not intend to requisition the same premises. And the owners of these earmarked premises were usually not told of the intention. To give you a practical example of the scale and ambition of civil defence planning at the time, I can give you some statistics from the 1965 Civil Defence Corps plans for the County of Essex. Within Essex, the headquarters section should have had about 800 members who would man the county control. There would have been 4 county subcontrols, 31 district controls, and various mobile controls that would replace any of the static or permanent controls if they were destroyed. The operational area for a warden section was based on a local authority district, such as a town, which would be divided into one or more sector posts. These, in turn, would be subdivided into 3 to 5 warden posts, and according to each one of these would be 4 to 5 patrol posts. It was these patrol posts, each manned by 2 wardens, that would have the immediate role of collecting information and passing it up to the higher level controls. To the certain approval of the volunteers, public houses were frequently designated to be warden or patrol posts in wartime. Essex itself was divided into 55 sectors, 264 warden posts, and 1,024 patrol posts, requiring 3,135 volunteers. The ward establishment of the Essex Welfare Section was about 5,300. The Rescue Section was divided into 5 columns with a total of 2,542 personnel. The Ambulance and First Aid Section would provide 8 columns, totaling 2,624 volunteers. In total, the planned volunteer law establishment of the Civil Defence Corps in Essex alone was about 15,000 people.
Can you just remind us what year we're at just now?
1956, I think it was. 1965.
1965. 1965.
As I said, in total, the planned voluntary establishment was 15,000 people. To this figure can be added the various other voluntary groups, the Industrial Civil Defence Service, the National Hospital Service Reserve, the Royal Observer Corps, and the Police and Fire Services, to give a total of about 20,000 people. In all, this would mean that some 2% of the population of the county would be directly involved in civil defence. But, despite the best efforts of the planners, advertising campaigns and many dedicated members, the Corps failed to generate a significant public support, particularly in the 1960s. Even in 1958, the Civil Defence Official Committee was expressing concern about apathy and shortage of equipment for civil defence. In 1959, the war establishment in England and Wales was some 800,000. But in reality, there were only 335,000 civil defence members, and not all of these were active. By 1965, the Corps was at some 25% of its war establishment. On 16th of January 1968, the then Prime Minister Harold Wilson announced, "We have decided to move civil defence to a care and maintenance basis. With a saving of about £14 million in 1968-69 and £20 million in subsequent years. The Civil Defence Corps, together with other volunteer organisations with a civil defence role, was stood down on 31st of March 1968. It was finally over. Or was it? In June 1990, the Conservative Party was returned to power under the leadership of Edward Heath. And in 1971, the newly elected government undertook a review of home defence, and a certain knowledge that the current state of preparedness meant that civil defence did not exist in any practical form. The review was to be completely cost-driven, and the civil servants considered various options based on expenditure. They recommended that the civil defence budget be increased to £15 million, which might just see the basis of a workable system. In the end, a budget of £10 million was decided on, and the emphasis was to be directed for the first time to civil emergencies. One immediate result was an attempt to revive civil defence at the local level. But given the political problems surrounding the very idea of civil defence, it was to be sold as the more politically acceptable emergency planning. Emergency services circulars now replaced the former civil defence circulars. And the first of these told county councils to establish small emergency planning teams to draw up the war emergency plans required under the 1967 regulations. They could go on to draw up plans for peacetime disasters, but only after the war plans had been completed. Counties also had to nominate one wartime headquarters that would normally be co-located with a peacetime headquarters. Cleverly, the word nominate meant that no physical preparation was required, and reflects the fact that under the regulations there was no requirement for such a headquarters to be prepared. An exercise called Survival 1 had been held in 1970, which found that local authorities could cope with any emergency from their own resources, which allowed the announcement to be made that a National Volunteer Corps, that is a re-established civil defence corps, would not be set up. And local authorities were encouraged to incorporate volunteer corps such as the Red Cross into their plans. Even the civil defence training statute for Easingmont, near York, was renamed the Home Defence College. The new impetus in home defence waned with the return of the Labour government in 1974. But in a repeat of 1971, when a new Conservative government was elected in 1979, it soon set up a review of civil preparedness for home defence. Some of the results were announced in 1981. But despite the government saying that local civil defence measures should be made public, this was not to apply to national plans. and most of the conclusions of the review remained secret. Significantly, the warning period was now to be measured in days rather than weeks, and accordingly the government considered it prudent to expand the civil defence programme. Emergency planning officers were now told that there might be as little as 7 days of warning attack, and essential plans, a phrase which was not defined, should be capable of implementation within 48 hours. This meant that the warning period was reduced to the same as it had been in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, as the principal of the Home Defence College told delegates to Easingworld, the country was on a permanent two-day notice for World War. In early 1980, as part of a low-key campaign to publicise civil defence, the booklet To Protect and Survive was put on sale for 50 pence. Local authorities were sent two copies free, but told that if they wanted any more, they had to buy them. The booklet and some 20 TV videotapes, together with radio tapes and newspaper inserts, covering such subjects as preparation of fallout room and fire precautions, actually existed secretly for some 5 years. The main aim of this material would be to convince people that although a nuclear attack would have devastating effects, everyone could significantly increase their chances of survival by improving the protection afforded by their own homes and by taking simple precautions. The emerging peace movements, spearheaded by a revitalised CND, ridiculed Protect and Survive Project. The booklet said that it tells you how to make your house and family as safe as possible under a nuclear attack. In practice, after saying that everything within a certain distance of a nuclear explosion would be destroyed, it concentrated entirely on how to improve the fallout protection a home could provide by preparing an inner refuge within a fallout room. The family or occupants would have to stay in this inner refuge for at least 48 hours. The refuge should be surrounded by dense materials such as bags or boxes of earth or sand or books or even clothing. The booklet's attackers lampooned this idea, suggesting that the government's only answer to a nuclear attack was to take cover under a pile of books. In reality, the booklet was actually a sensible approach to a difficult practical presentation problem, and in fact a 14-inch thickness of books would give the same degree of protection against fallout as 4 inches of concrete. Protect and Survive replaced
very... May I
yes,
ask
no?
a question here? You described the precaution which the book recommended that people should install in their homes. In a context where a warning of the event that they were protecting themselves against would be very short. Therefore, anybody who really wants to be prepared would have to set this up, not knowing whether it was going to happen or not. And one can see that the actual motivation to give over your living room to a pile of sandbags.
Well, it depends how messy the room is in the first place.
Well,
it
indeed,
resembled
yes.
my living room already. No, I think that was one of the criticisms of the book.
Yes.
I'll go on to touch on some of the previous ones and what they suggested you do in the time. So.
I mean, in the real world War II, they came and they built proper air raid shelters in your garden. Or you had these metal, Morrison shelters that you could actually use as a dining table.
Oh yes, the cage ones, yes.
The cage ones, yes.
No, I think it was, I'll touch on the measures again. It's quite as I said, Protect and Survive replaced a previous booklet entitled Advising the Householder on Protection Against Nuclear Attack. This had been published in 1963 and had given very similar advice but was much less realistic, as you touched on, suggesting, for example, that the window frame in the chosen fallout room should be removed and replaced by a double thickness of bricks. It showed extensive use being made of sandbags, but Protect and Survive used more immediately available things like bags, boxes and drawers. A smaller pamphlet had been published even earlier, in 1957, called simply The Hydrogen Bomb. It gave as much emphasis to protection near the blast, which was not covered by the later two pamphlets, as fallout. Whilst mentioning a refuge room, The Hydrogen Bomb pamphlet recommended using a spit trench, advising the householder also suggested the trench could be used, but then showed a well-built and equipped trench 6 feet deep by 6 feet wide, without any suggestion about the amount of labour needed to shift such a huge amount of earth or the subsequent problems of living in. In reality, the government did very little to defend or explain Protect and Survive or its policies, and it met a significant defeat in the propaganda war waged by the peace groups. It was about to suffer another. In May 1981, the Home Office wrote to the county councils, inviting them to take part in a major home defence exercise called Hard Rock. According to the exercise specification prepared by that office, Hard Rock was to be a national civil and military home defence command post exercise, with conventional warfare and post-strike phases. The 1974 Civil Defence Regulations required local authorities to make plans for civil defence, but there was no requirement to take part in exercises like Hard Rock. As well as ideological objections, many had no realistic plans in place, and the government made no extra funds available for them to take part. In the end, 20 out of the 54 county-level authorities politely declined to take part in Hard Rock, and a further 7 said they would only play on a limited basis. This effectively killed the exercise, and in July 1982, the Home Secretary announced that Hard Rock would be postponed. In reality, the central government was as ill-prepared to take part in the exercise as most local authorities. Whilst the emphasis as far as the councils were concerned was on preparing civil defence plans, by the mid-1980s, planning for peacetime emergencies was receiving increasing attention. In its 1983 election manifesto, the Conservative Party announced they would introduce legislation to enable civil defence resources to be used in peacetime emergencies. This became known as the All Hazards Approach for Emergencies, and resulted, with the assistance of the Chernobyl accident, in the passing of the Civil Protection in Peacetime Act in 1986. This stated that there were common features in plans for wartime and peacetime emergencies, and the Act allowed a local authority to use its civil defence resources, including emergency planning staff, emergency centres and communications equipment, for peacetime emergencies. In the days of the Civil Defence Corps, such resources were quite often used, as for example at the Aberdeen disaster in 1966, but this was not, strictly speaking, allowed for in the provision of the Civil Defence grant that local authorities received. However, there were still restrictions on the use of these resources, which were largely funded by the central government. The primary task of the emergency planning teams would continue to be the preparation of civil defence plans, and the civil defence grant could not be used for any activity directed towards purely peacetime emergencies. In 1987, changes were made to the way local authorities' civil defence activities were funded through the annual civil defence grant. Central government, through the Home Office, could now pay the whole cost of emergency planning staff. Up to this point, central government assisted local government by paying 75% of costs emergency planners and approved the cost of setting up but not maintaining emergency centres. By 1988, local authorities in England and Wales were employing a total of 659 emergency planners, who were spending some 51% of their time drawing up plans under the 1983 regulations. But by now, momentous events were happening on the world stage. In 1989, the Soviet Union began withdrawing its troops from Eastern Europe and the Berlin Wall fell. The Cold War was effectively over. The government soon started to receive representations to repeal the civil defence legislation, and in October 1990, the Home Secretary initiated a review of future options for civil defence arrangements in the light of developments in these legislations. It was then quickly announced that the planning programme of implementation would continue, but all the civil defence building and other capital work would cease. In 1993, the new civil defence regulations were introduced to replace the 83 regulations. From now on, counties only had to make, keep under review and revise plans for what were referred to simply as civil defence purposes. There was no longer a requirement to maintain a protected emergency centre, and central government would no longer fund the training of local scientific advisors. Although it was never officially announced, civil defence was now there. Local authorities developed plans for civil emergencies such as floods and industrial accidents without reference to civil defence. All pretence of central government planning for civil defence was also abandoned. The Civil Defence Act 1948, however, remained on the statute books until 2004, when it was replaced by the Civil Contingencies Act, which we'll look at a little later on in some detail. My own involvement in civil defence began in 1989. As a middle-ranking officer in Surrey Fire and Rescue Service, I was appointed as the service's Brigade Emergency Planning Staff Officer, or BEPSO, as it was referred to. And just to underline the fact that it was 20 years ago, I had brown hair and no glasses. The government required each individual brigade to have a BEPSO, half of whose salary and costs were funded by the Home Office, and our job was to prepare the service's war plan. This was a large document, about that thick, with the words war plan clearly written in secret on the cover. It outlined how the service would operate in the event of a nuclear attack, and was based on planning assumptions of 48 hours warning, so it had to be quite detailed. I would attend conferences and training exercises where, with a perfectly straight face, we would sit around and calculate how many fire stations and staff would be left functional in the event of a nuclear attack. I also recall surveying our fire stations to work out the levels of fallout protection afforded by each building, and providing awareness training to board and unused staff. However, very shrewdly, my chief fire officer and others saw the BEPSO role as a free resource sponsored by the Home Office. So I spent about half my time planning for war and the other half as his personal staff officer and bag carrier. Having invested all this money, the Home Office, quite understandably, wanted to keep tabs on our progress and development of the war plan. Whenever they visited the brigade, I was under strict instructions from my boss to tell them that it was about 90 to 95% complete. In fact, whenever they asked, it was always 90 to 95% complete, as that way the funding would continue to flow in. I spent a number of years in that role before moving on and upward and to different fire and rescue services. Looking back now, some 20 years, our activity seems quite bizarre and unreal. But it was all very real at the time, and undertaken in all seriousness. As you can imagine, as Ted touched on earlier, a lot of the infrastructure from that period still exists, because most of it was designed to survive a nuclear strike after all, and some of it can still be seen in the surrounding area if you know where to look. For example, underneath County Hall is a hardened bunker with blast-proof doors some 9 inches thick, including a diesel generator and several water supplies. It's something of a Cold War relic, and a shadow of its former self, and we use it for occasional archive storage. That unassuming brown door is the entrance to it, and that's a group of keen students from Xavier Ruskin to be shown around to the main time. Other surviving relics include the Cambridge Regional War Room. This building can still be found just behind the government offices in Shaftesbury Road, now surrounded by a quiet little housing estate. It was constructed in the mid-1950s in response to the government demand that there should be the provision of protected control rooms with communications at local authority and regional level. The regional war rooms would have reported to a central government war room in London. The model war room was a two-storey structure built either on the surface, as this was, or with one level underground. It would have a reinforced concrete roof, which would be capable of withstanding a 500-pound bomb, and walls 5 feet thick. The new buildings are expected to cost £36,720 to build, which is about £1 million at current prices, with an extra £29,840 a plant. A total at today's prices is about just over £1.75 million. This would have been a huge expenditure for a country in desperate economic times and shows the importance attached to civil defence at the time. Now, I must apologise, it's not a particularly clear plan, but the heart of the war room was a two-storey operations and map room. Dominating this room and filling one wall was a regional map made of metal so that magnetic symbols could be used. The rooms facing into the operations room on both levels had large windows so that the displays could be easily seen. The war room would have been helpless without an effective communication system, and extensive telephone and telegraph facilities were included. Most plans also included provision for motorcycle dispatch rounds, and later plans included the use of radios. It was expected that the war rooms would have to be manned continuously, and domestic facilities were provided, and as it was thought that at least one shift might have to remain in the war room during an attack, small dormitories were provided. The operational staff for the war room would have been provided by the Civil Defence Corps, the police, ambulance services and so on. But they would also need a support staff to run the map and operations room and man the communications facilities. These would have come from government departments with offices nearby, but finding these people was a problem throughout the life of the war rooms. Originally it was thought that two shifts would be sufficient, but later a third was added to cover the sickness, etc. Each shift was to consist of 21 people manning the operations room and signals office, but this later crept upwards, especially when fallout reporting was added to the roles, so that the shift increased to 37. Staff for these shifts were only recruited for peacetime exercise and training purposes, and little thought seems to have been given to manning the war rooms in an actual war. Even so, as we've already seen, volunteers were hard to come by. Government departments were reluctant to release staff for training or to pay overtime. Quite clearly, some things never change. So that was the past. What of today? What is the contemporary role of emergency planning? Well, we now work under the requirements of a new piece of legislation, the Civil Contingencies Act 2004. Even prior to the events of 11th of September 2001, the government had signalled that it intended to overhaul Britain's outdated national emergency planning system. The new act was designed to create a modern civil defence framework and responds to MPs' criticism that Britain's emergency services lacked capabilities and resources to cope with a major terrorist attack. The Act was designed to deliver a single framework of civil protection in the United Kingdom capable of meeting the challenges of the 21st century. The Act is separated into two key parts. Local arrangements for civil protection, which is part one, and emergency powers, which is part two. In the event of a natural disaster or terrorist attack, part two allows the government to deploy the armed services, ban public assembly, impose travel restrictions, force evacuations, and prevent public access, etc. sensitive areas. As we've seen, in the United Kingdom, all civil protection activity at the local level was empowered by civil defence legislation dating from 1948. The legislation defined the events local responders should prepare for in terms of hostile attack from a foreign power. With the ending of the Cold War, such a threat evaporated, and local efforts in recent years have been focused on preparing for civil emergencies, such as localised flooding and major transport accidents. The provisions for emergency powers were based on the Emergency Powers Act 1920, which defined an emergency in terms of certain services and resources which provided the community with the essentials of life. Clearly, the 1920 Act was out of date and didn't reflect the new threats the UK faced. For example, the 1920 Act did not cover terrorist activities or threats to the environment. Emergency powers under the Act allow for special temporary legislation to deal with grave emergencies in the UK. They cannot be used to instigate martial law, undermine Parliament, ban political parties, or anything else of that nature. Emergency powers legislation is only for dealing with serious emergencies that require emergency response. It is basically an instrument of last resort. Interestingly, previous emergency powers under the Emergency Powers Act 1920 were only used 12 times in their history. The Civil Contingencies Act came into force in April 2005 and it gives clear expectations and responsibilities for frontline responders at the local level to ensure they're prepared to deal with the full range of emergencies from localised incidents through to catastrophic emergencies. It divides local responders into two categories. Category 1 responders, who are people such as the Blue Light Emergency Services, local authorities such as mine, Marine and Coast Guard Agency, and the Environment Agency. Category 2 responders are the utilities, gas, electric, water, etc., telecommunications, harbour authorities, rail operators, and the health and safety executive. Category 1 responders are required to develop emergency plans, make business continuity management arrangements, share information and cooperate with other responders to enhance coordination, and provide advice and assistance to local businesses and voluntary organisations about business continuity management. Essentially, the Act focuses local responders to work in a far more coordinated manner than they did before, and to formulate a joint approach to emergency planning and response. This is done via a group known as the Local Resilience Board, commonly referred to as the LRF. The LRF is chaired by their Chief Constable and is made up of representatives from both Category 1 and Category 2 responders. It also has a number of subgroups which actually carry out the day-to-day liaison work. Its primary role is the assessment and treatment of risk. This is done in a relatively straightforward way, whereby the likelihood of an event occurring is offset against the potential impact should it occur. For example, the likelihood of a jumbo jet crashing on Cambridge is hopefully low, but the impact would be very high. The government produces its own matrix, the National Risk Register, based on their assumptions for national threats. And there you can see them with the relative impact against relative likelihood. As we can see, pandemic flu and terrorist attacks are considered to pose the highest threats nationally.
I'm a bit surprised at the risk level for electronic attacks.
It looks relatively high likelihood, but relatively little impact, I think.
That's right.
Well, I suppose a lot of this is obviously based...
We're sort of now getting really statistical. You would expect something like electronic attacks, which is a very diffuse sort of threat. Mm. You know, it can vary from trivial to catastrophic. That should be represented not by one of your stock ovals there, but by some sort of band.
spreading across the diagram, so that perhaps most of it is highly likely but low risk, but some of it you could represent as being perhaps not all that likely, but if it does arrive, you know, it will knock out communications at the Ministry of Defence or something like that.
But the metric or relative impact is very ill-defined, in the sense that if you're considering these in terms of lives that may be lost, an electronic attack wouldn't necessarily have much of
an impact.
Whereas pandemic,
it might be one link in a chain which could lead to, you know, the problem about all of these processes is that they can branch in different directions, but they are sequential in their cumulative effect.
I think what's interesting with this, when we're talking about this, I think the other thing we have to take into account is there's quite a political side of this as well. And there are some issues that, in terms of loss of life, would be unacceptable as far as the government is concerned. There are high impact things in terms of sort of impact on the public from what they're seeing. Because the thing that's always struck me when I've been doing plans for this is why terrorist groups go through such an effort to target what are difficult high profile targets, where if they wanted to disrupt daily life, it would just be a plain nuisance. It would be very simple to be a thorn inside, very difficult to stop. They do go to some elaborate efforts to do high-profile incidents. But then what is interesting is the ones they point out, pandemic, flu, terrorist attacks on transport in crowded places, the relatively lower ones, I think, like animal disease and transport accidents and industrial accidents, you've got pretty good controls in place. But it is interesting because I think as soon as you put something like this up, obviously you've got umpteen different viewpoints on what is a threat.
Well, in fact, that is just a snapshot from one particular angle.
And of course, that will be that's a national register. That same graph will be different in Cambridgeshire. Because, let's be honest, the threat of terrorist attack in Cambridge is going to be a lot lower than London. Probably in our area, inland flooding, coastal flooding is going to be the greatest thing. And probably in terms of one that the public are concerned about, probably. The results of the local risk assessment are really what informs our plans, which ones are developed, and also guide our local exercise and training trip. Another key requirement of the Act, which has changed over the years, is a new emphasis on business continuity planning. In fact, the Act places a legal duty on all Category 1 responders to develop and maintain plans that will ensure that they can continue to deliver their functions in an emergency, with a caveat that it's so far as it's reasonably practical. These duties relate to all Category 1 responders' functions. That is the provision of key services, not just their emergency response functions. And this entails looking beyond the immediate environment and considering the resilience of those organisations that they rely on to maintain key services, including any third parties that might provide services on their behalf. This is becoming extremely pertinent when local authorities are currently moving away from being providers of functions. Functions do commissions and services, and I'll touch on that a bit more later. While this duty is limited only to those events defined as an emergency by the Act, organisations are encouraged to take a broader approach to the process, with the view that by planning for the worst case scenario, it's more likely they'll be able to deal with other challenges. It also speaks for itself that unless organisations can maintain their own services, they won't be able to extend and maintain the response to help others and meet their civil protection function. In the case of local authorities, the Act also gives them an additional duty, and that's to promote and provide general business continuity planning advice to commercial and voluntary organisations in their area. This duty is directly linked to the government's overall resilience agenda. Not only does it aim to enable local businesses to better maintain critical elements of their service and recover more quickly should an incident arise, it also represents an opportunity for the sharing of best practice and experience between the commercial, voluntary and statutory sector. So what does the future hold for emergency planning? I think if I'd been given this talk about 12 to 18 months ago, I would have said that the future was reasonably bright. Unfortunately, the bulk of emergency planning duties rest with local authorities. And as we know, they're having a torrid time with it at the moment. With nearly all authorities going through a phase of unparalleled cuts and restructuring. In austere times, authorities are positioning themselves as commissioners of services rather than the providers of functions. I currently have a team of seven. I don't know what the immediate future holds, but the only thing I know for certain is that come April 2011, my team will be much smaller, probably half. Of course, this throws up concerns about local authorities' ability to comply with their statutory duties under the Act. But the Act is worded very loosely and can be open to interpretation. For example, one of the duties is to maintain emergency plans. Does this mean a team of 20 emergency planners diligently writing, reviewing and exercising plans? Or does it mean that every 6 months a person takes down a plan from the shelf, spends half an hour checking that the contact names and numbers are still valid, and then places it back on the shelf? Within the letter of the law, those could be viewed as maintaining the plan. This may be a risky policy for an authority to pursue, but balanced against the pressing requirement to look after vulnerable children in care or feeding and accommodating the elderly, emergency planning, important as it is low down the pecking order. And I don't think many local politicians have been elected on the strength of their emergency planning policy. Central government is currently consulting on a programme called Community Resilience. This programme has a number of aims. It wants to increase individual, family and community resilience against all threats and hazards. It wants to support and enable the existing community resilience. And it wants to support effective dialogue between the community and the practitioner's supporter. In effect, it wants to help people to help themselves, which seems to chime with the government's current big society issue. However, as we have seen, we've been down this route before, and volunteers have been a thorny problem, even in the 1940s and 50s, when it could be argued that the public were perhaps more biddable than they are today. So forgive me if I'm painting too bleak a picture, but resources will be scarce, and the days of tens of thousands of uniformed volunteers are not far. There will undoubtedly be more emphasis placed on helping people to help themselves. And local planning teams will become leaner, with far greater partnership working to achieve economies of scale. In closing, I would say this to you. Despite the austere times we live in, I can reassure you that you are still in safe hands. And if the worst does come to the worst, we can always paste up some posters urging everybody to keep calm and carry on.
Is it something that's a bit hush-hush, certain aspects of it, or the accessibility thing?
myself, I think the National Risk Register is given to us. I think it would probably be an unwise county council or a county run responder that vary greatly. It will vary wherever you are in the country, because obviously something in London, the Risk Register in London is something like different from the Risk Register in Canada or the Wales or Cornwall or Wales or something like that. And it is a very subjective view, because within the local resilience board we have a community risk register group who meet regularly to assess risks in the county, and they will go through and they'll every month they'll look at them, have they increased, decreased, and need to change the figure we attach to them. But it is a fairly subjective view. And there's also, as I say, some political overtones. But I think as my view is better than nothing. It's a broad framework to hang your emergency planning on. Because one of the issues we had, obviously we, as I've touched on, but we're a fairly small team, but finite resources. We will have even less in 12 months' time. We are really getting to the point, as local authorities are in general, of saying, what are our real priorities and what will we take a chance on? So as a tool to actually identify what we want to work on and what we want to exercise, it's very useful. It is subjective.
I mean, I notice you've got attacks at the top, and I mean, I think terrorism, you know, that's obviously been something that people have been saying is quite likely, relatively likely.
Yeah.
And so I suppose that's a sort of topical one, isn't it?
I think it's because the probably the political fallout and something like that is high up. Imagine if you look at 7/7, that was probably not quite the bolt out of the blue that people think, because I think the shock factor with that was that there were suicide bombs for the first time on the UK mainland. Had they been timed with devices in the rucksack, somebody just left on the tube and walked away in 15 minutes to come up, would have been slightly different, but I think the shock factor is the main thing. Now, if we look at another 7/7 tomorrow, I think the public would be pretty unforgiving if we couldn't respond better than we did.
I think there was a secondary attack, wasn't there? And it didn't go off. So a week or so later.
So oh, there was the
yes,
the
second one. And yes, it was just lucky that nothing happened.
Yes, they got the
sure, wasn't that the stop one?
But isn't there a difference in that there is that political element, but also that it's relating to people rather than there's a human behind it rather
yes.
than these other, the government can't really, well, they can take steps to deal with major traffic accidents, but it's not like someone's planning to have an accident. You won't be planning to have that accident, so there's a greater responsibility in that you're trying to deal with other humans as opposed to some weather system.
Because you do know when that works.
You know, but on the other hand, traffic accidents are not exactly an everyday event when you get the patch of road, they're often enough for.
Maybe a better example would be to take the flooding.
Yes.
Not to parse your language too much, but you made the comment that it would be unwise for Category 1 responders to bid from the register too much. What was that with respect to, in terms of being able to defend your actions to central, or decisions made to central governments, or you wouldn't have another document from which to work, so...
I would say that probably from the point of view that I think what I'm saying now actually got myself in it, but I think what you touched on, yeah, I think from a political point of view you would be wise to follow the guidance. I mean I couldn't imagine that anyone going through this process would be that far from the mark anyway, but and what you will find, I think, to a certain extent, the days of the sort of willful disobedience, wrong word, really, a couple of words. But in the days of the nuclear free zones in the 80s and the 90s, that sort of literally stepping back by the book of when they refused to play the hard rock and then in the end of the authorities. I don't see that as much.
You brought back the language, some of the language, some of the language of the 1940s, but there's a kind of timeline in it which does seem to be leading towards what I see as a kind of underlying message in what you're saying. If you go back to the 1940s, towards the end of and just after the World War, the civilian precautions had been very effectively and concretely and quickly been laid out. Admittedly, it was wartime, there was a national emergency that everybody was conscious of and reacting to, but remarkable calm. Now, when I began my career, I was actually working in the War Office, and that gave me some opportunity to observe good army officers at work, and they are very efficient and effective at getting a task done. And that reminded me again of the 2001 foot and mouth epidemic, which was on the verge of becoming a shambles when they put a senior army officer in charge and just swept the whole thing aside in a few days. Which leads me on to the question, in terms of the sort of literature that you've been displaying and talking about, and the delegation of these various responsibilities to local authorities, I'm jotting my question. Yes. How good are local authorities at organising things and at reacting quickly and effectively?
The first question I'll ask you about that is there are no camp councils in the room.
Not to my knowledge.
Or people related to council councils.
There might have been, but he isn't here.
My honest answer would be not very good.
Yeah.
I've seen to a certain extent, claim that I've been in and out of services as disciplined as the army, but I've been in a semi-discipline organisation. I think the two factors that mitigate against local authorities are essentially that they don't do it often enough. Within the fire service and police department, to a certain extent, you are going out half a dozen times a day and you are, even if it's a small incident, you're practicing your command and control techniques.
Yes.
You're doing it constantly. And then occasionally, once in a blue, you'll get a large incident where you practice the whole thing. But,
yeah, but the
day in, day out, your processes are exactly the same. They're just scaled up or down. you also have a greater, as you said, with the army, not quite as strong as the army, but to a greater extent than the civilian outfit. And you do have a command and control ethos that runs through it, that if you say something, that's got to be done, it needs done. So I think three things really the local authorities have to do. They don't have enough personnel to realistically deal with a long-term incident. Because in the fire service and other services you have shifts of people, so once you've done 6 hours of an incident, another shift of people come in. We don't have that resilience in depth, that if something happened and we committed, certainly my team, probably 4 to 6 hours, it's used up and there's no one to take that. So realistically you have no depth of resilience. You do not have the command and control ethos, so essentially people don't snatch your attention and tell you to do something. And through no fault of their own, it doesn't happen often enough for local authorities to really get practice at it. I've been in my current role 18 months and I have a pager, it hasn't gone off once. We've had a few minor incidents which have sort of stumbled onto the radar for one reason or another. And I could probably point to some of my team who've been there 4 or 5 years. There have probably been to 1 or 2 substantial incidents in their time. We don't practice it enough. In answer to your question, I would say no, they're not good because they've got practice, they don't have resilience.
And there's an aspect to it as well. I mean, you know, as if you like, an active service fire officer or policeman, you have a mental, both from experience and from training, you have a mental picture of scenarios that you might be involved in. And you have, so to speak, a kind of rather generalised agenda that you can quickly activate.
Recognised, was it recognition prior decision making?
Is that what it's called?
You come to somebody and say, I've seen one of these before, we did that, this happened.
Yeah, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Whereas local authorities are not going to have that mindset. The people working,
yes,
they're not going to.
But I think it's because they don't have that bank of experience. As I say, that recognition prior decision making, it's good in some ways and it's bad in others. Because you can start making assumptions about things that aren't valid. But in general, as you say, as you go through your career and you gain this experience, it does become easier. Because the other beauty of it is you can weigh incidents against other incidents and you sort of get a figure on this one's what's bad. And I think what happens if you get an incident in local authority, we tend to jump at everything. They don't have the experience to say, well, actually, this isn't much, or actually, this is something we need to get hold of now because you've got 3 hours to be out of control. And they have all that back experience.
Is there not also the issue that we expect a greater range of things from the local authority than we do, say, the army? That in that getting now, then before you had the soldier in charge of it, you probably had some county council guy or some equivalent who had to worry about how he was dealing with people, whereas once you appointed someone like an army officer, you just tell him to get the job done. He's not going to this isn't simplifying somewhat, but he's focused on getting the job done, not worrying about how hats are pulled on the ground and the process of it.
Yeah. He doesn't want to be diplomatic.
No, yeah. Yes, those elements where, so the job is in some sense more straightforward for the firefighters, not easier, but they've just got to get in, get people out and save them. Whereas your local county councillor has to worry about, have they been polite, have they so you're optimizing with respect.
I think the other thing to remember is the incredibly small percentage of the county council. And when you were asking me if we could deal with things, I was actually talking about emergency planning team, probably isn't that experienced. If you look at the vast amount of different work that the local authorities do, we've got people out there who may have a role to play, but they've never even heard of emergency planning or what it is. And then suddenly, bang, you're in training standards, and put them out, or radius kicks off, and what do I do? I've never even known the plan. And that is the problem. It's very easy for emergency planners to say, well, you should have read the plan, it's on the shelf, it's there. These people have got 20 other hugely demanding things. In an ideal world, with fantastic enough resources, it would be well run, but I think it's run about as well as it can. I think the resources that we set aside. I think the other thing is that the further away we're getting from the old Civil Defence Corps militaristic style, and it's gradually phasing out, the less knowledge people are going to have that for that sort of operating units.
In the war years, people were perhaps a bit more switched on and there was a bit more the community element, and
listening could be a recent chronology there, but you know, other things, you know, actually the mentality isn't there because people haven't come before you, they haven't used to coming together, and there's more isolation about.
I think there's the other thing that's probably crept in over the years is probably, and we found it in the fire service as well, the commoditization of local authority services, where there's the expectation that you buy that, it's just like you buy a car or a house, I buy my services from the council, why isn't it there? And this, I can see probably what the push of the current government is trying to push it back, so actually, you can do it off yourselves. You don't have to sit and wait for it to be done for you. And unfortunately, less and less will be done for you.
This big society thing, in some ways, this keep calm and carry on, was about a bit of a dance army, wasn't it?
Yes.
Where volunteers came together.
Mm.
And perhaps that's what Cameron's trying to do, trying to get people to come together. But that the mentality hasn't been there for many years. Perhaps they don't have the motivation to do it themselves.
As an example, I can give, we always just had terrible trouble in the fire group, because not so much in Surrey, but I served in Suffolk and Cambridge. And those two were quite heavily retained or part-time fire service, probably three-quarters of the personnel were retained. Whereby they wore a pager, they were retained on the 2000-year page, they got called out. We used to have an awful problem actually recruiting people. And it seemed, in the 30 years I was in, it seemed to get worse. Now, I don't know whether that was a general apathy creeping into the population where they didn't feel that they wanted to volunteer for things, or they didn't feel part of the community. But a lot of the retained stations that I knew were on virtually any extension, because we got to the point where they just wanted to be able to quit. And that was becoming increasingly more problem.
This is the assumption that Cameron made, the big society, isn't it, that people will want to take part.
Yeah.
You know, but for the goodness of it.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have that thing, there isn't that collective responsibility to come together, then, you know, handling these sort of things is going to be difficult, because, you know, communities have to come together.
Mm. And at the same time, it's been the nation with the longest working hours in Europe.
You know, you don't have to, you can work as many hours as you want, but I mean, what sort of, how are people going to feel after doing all, you know, doing all these, they don't have the time or the energy, the mental energy to do this.
And then there's also there's been drifting apart of the population in general and authority, whether it is local or national. Go back, say, in 30 years, people would be more willing to cooperate then with some kind of national call to solidarity, as it were. And certainly go back 50 years, and they would have been very willing, because the memories of the war were just so recent. When, but nowadays, I think, authorities call for big society in different bodies is only there's a kind of distrust, because there is actually, I think in general, any risk that there might be in general is below the threshold of perception as a serious risk. So why bother? And again, you know, if you're talking about people volunteering to collaborate in keeping local life going, whatever it is, what more would they do than they do now, unless they do it under the direction of pay people to do. There's a whole sort of complicated psychology of whether or not you should join in. But anyway, thank you ever so much. I mean, I think we could carry on discussing this sort of thing forever and ever and ever, because you've raised so many questions and done it so beautifully. So thank you very much indeed.